This is Future of Water, where we talk about all the ways in which companies, utilities, and people are addressing the challenges and opportunities in water. Today, we're going to talk with Bluefield's Eric Bindler and Nina Rossiter about telecoms and their role in water. Not theirs specifically, but telecoms. You might think they're unrelated, but I can promise you that is not the case. In fact, there's more in common than we all realize and might want to know about. Eric and Nina are concluding a deep dive analysis for their upcoming report, Connecting Water Infrastructure Telecom Company Strategies in the Global Digital Water Market. So rather than wait it out and force you to wait until the details are released in Bluefield's weekly Waterline newsletter, that's a hint. You can subscribe for free. All you got to do is go to our website, bluefieldresearch.com. I thought we'd talk more informally about the findings of the report, what they're seeing, and what they had a tough time putting in words, or at least on paper. But before we talk to them, let's talk about the news. So number one, Culligan International, the consumer-focused water solutions and services company, Culligan, I think we've all seen it, I believe. They're being acquired by another PE firm, BDT Capital Partners, for $6 billion. Culligan is a highly acquisitive company that is being sold by Advent International and Centerbridge Partners. Culligan has made 90 acquisitions since Advent bought it in 2016, mostly small family-owned companies in European markets. I think primarily like Germany, Italy, Spain, among others. But Advent, to give you an idea, so how far it's come, Advent bought Culligan from Centerbridge in a deal that valued the company at about $915 million. So it's definitely grown, $915 million to $6 billion in only a couple of years since 2016. Number two, Core Maine, with $3.4 billion in revenue, is ready to go public. This is a move that apparently has been in the works for years. Core Maine's the largest distributor of water, sewer, fire protection, and storm drain products in the U.S. It has made some acquisitions, 12 in total, since it became independent about 4 years ago from HD Supply. So it's interesting to see them going public. We'll have to keep monitoring that as another firm goes public. And hey, following that same thread, number three, GS Enema, the Spanish water treatment company that was acquired by GS Engineering or GSENC in 2011, is going public as well. So GS Enema became a wholly owned subsidiary in 2019. So now it looks like it's heading in the public direction. So we at Bluefield, we've always had an eye out for Enema couple of reasons. One, its role in desal that we've been looking at over the better part of the decade, but also more recently in Brazil, where it's also been active. It was one of the 15 firms that was looking to purchase the Rio de Janeiro State Water Company a couple months ago. Also, I guess maybe more importantly, I'm not going to lie, Enema has a great logo for what that's worth. So check that out. I've always liked that. I've noticed it for years and years and thought it was pretty cool. So that being said, three news items. There you have it. You got one on Culligan, one on Core and Maine, and one on GS Enema. A little bit local, a little bit global. As a reminder, sign up for Waterline. That's Bluefield's weekly newsletter to receive curated news and data from our team of water experts. It's easy. All you got to do is provide an email. Just get our website. Subscribe to the Future Water. That's number two. We want to make this podcast better and more informative. So don't hesitate to reach out to us at waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com with ideas and questions. Curious minds want to know what you're thinking about or what you'd like to think about. So let's do it. Let's get to our guests, Eric and Nina. Here we go. All right. So I'm joined here by Eric Bindler and Nina Rossiter. Eric, long time no talk. How are things?
Things are good. Trying to buy a house. So that's a pretty exciting experience in this market.
One of the millions of people trying to buy a house during the later stages of a pandemic.
Yeah, exactly.
good luck with that. I don't know. It's probably easier to buy a house than it is to buy a pallet of lumber these days, as far as I can tell from supply chain.
It's a fair point, or a semiconductor for that matter.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't know where I would go buy a semiconductor, but other than a car. So Nina, first time on the Future of Water. How's it going?
I have to say I'm a little nervous, but happy to be here. And I'm finally back in Boston. It's been warmer. So doing a lot of bike rides around the Charles River. And I like that. And also it's stone fruit season. So you can't go wrong with peaches and nectarines for snacks.
So, I mean, of all the people at Bluefield, so you're an analyst and you work closely with Eric on the digital side of things. You have been the most nomadic, I think, of anybody here. I mean, you've been in the Caribbean for a couple of months. You've been in Savannah. No, did you went to Charleston at one point, South Carolina? You went to where else?
I did Atlanta, New York. Yeah, really taking advantage of COVID safe travel.
Right, right.
Doing a lot of that, but now back in Boston for a bit.
Nice. All right. Well, as I mentioned in the intro to everybody who's still listening to this podcast, one of the things we'd like to talk about are obviously telecoms. I've been excited about this for a long time. There are a lot of factors at play when it comes to digitization, communications, communication protocols. So can we just start at the beginning? And so, I mean, maybe why have we done a deep dive analysis in the telecommunications players, but also really these players and what their role is in water? So Eric, why don't we start with you? What's your take?
Yeah. So, I mean, in general, obviously, you know, for our subscribers, for our listeners, in the context of our Digital Water Insight service, we look a lot at the competitive landscape of companies that are active in one way or another in digital water. So certainly there's no shortage of incumbents, of pure plays, of startups that are targeting digital water. But we've also been increasingly, I'd say, over the past, you know, maybe a year or two, looking at some of those players that we consider to be outsiders looking in, right? Firms of different kinds that are kind of on the margins of digital water, but they're increasingly looking to take more active strategic positions. They're building their footprints, thinking more actively and strategically about the water industry. So we've done some analysis of big tech companies like Amazon and Microsoft. We've looked at a number of financial firms that are getting more involved in the water industry. But I think the telecommunications players are another interesting subgroup of these kind of outsiders that, you know, certainly they have a position. They've long had positions in water. They provide a critical service that just about any business has to take advantage of if they're trying to move data from place to place, but they're increasingly looking at water specifically as an opportunity to build and to grow. In the context of the water industry, obviously, as we're seeing more and more adoption of digital technology, it means there's more data being generated all over the place, right? Across utilities, asset bases, across their service areas. But for that to be useful, it really has to be mobile. It has to get back to a place where staff can actually look at it, access it, use it, analyze it, whether that be, you know, from a smart meter back to the meter data management software, or from IoT devices out on the network back into an operations management platform. And all of that has to be reasonably quick. It has to be reasonably inexpensive. You know, it has to be cost effective for utilities to take advantage of it. And so that's where the telecoms players and telecommunications networks really kind of are essential to this process. And so what we're really kind of interested in here is the way that telecommunications players of all stripes, you know, around the world are looking at leveraging that infrastructure that they already have and that footprint that they already have to get more involved in digital water.
Yeah, I think that helps a lot, because I do think that it's kind of overlooked, like how is all this information moved from one place to another? And I honestly, you know, if you spoke to my mother, who hopefully is not listening to this podcast, I'll hear more about it. But the fact is, she's not thinking about, you know, her meter at her house and how they've got to get that information back into the central utility CRM system to understand, hey, what are the billing, you know, how is it moving? But also from the assets themselves, whether it be the pumps, the lift stations, the workforce as well. So before I'm getting into details, but Nina, so Eric's sort of given us a reason of why we at Bluefield have looked at it, but that's interesting, I think. And then the next question for you would be, why do the telecoms care? I mean, is water a huge opportunity for them?
Well, what we're seeing and hearing is that the telecoms industry is increasingly saturated. So if we look, and we have looked at the top four cell carriers in the US, net new postpaid activations was down 29% from their 2014 peak. And if we look at the UK, we're seeing a similar trend with an average growth rate of 1.6 per year in the past 3 years. And if you think about the communication landscape as a whole, these telecoms own the rails for these transmissions. So it only makes sense for them to take advantage of their strong position, which already has a high barrier to entry. And then with the pandemic, we've seen a huge push to remote work with support from government stimulus. And that's aside from growing movement towards smart cities. So this creates a space that's beneficial for telecoms to increase their revenue and expand their services. And then on top of that, we see these telecoms already have existing relationships and brand recognition, right? So while there are differences that they'll have to adapt to serve the water industry, they still already have the foot in the door with cities and customers.
I mean, so basically, they're just there, right? And so they're part of the business, whether they want to be or not.
Exactly.
Yeah. So if they're at the center, so why not either, you know, you just continuing business as usual and just move the information or play a role, or do you develop a strategy? So that's sort of the, could we call that the supply side of the equation? Now, really looking at the demand side, and that being the water utility, right? They're the ones who are using the services. What did they need to think about? And I guess maybe do they think about this, and to what extent when it comes to data communications and transmissions? What do you think about that, Eric?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you know, if you think about kind of the landscape of digital water applications or use cases, they all kind of have different types of needs or different requirements from a telecommunications perspective, right? So if you're thinking about, let's say, smart metering or you know, IoT, Internet of Things, remote monitoring, you're talking about hundreds, maybe if it's a large utility, even thousands of devices that are spread across a wide, potentially kind of remote geographic area, but they're really only sending very small packets of data, maybe every 15 minutes, once an hour, once every couple hours. So, you know, those devices, that particular use case, it doesn't really need a lot of bandwidth, right? But you do need wide network coverage. You need to make sure that network is extending to each of those assets, and also that there's pretty good penetration, because a lot of meters, you know, particularly in certain parts of the US, for example, they're in people's basements, right? They're kind of underground. IoT devices as well, if they're kind of in the pipe network or inside manholes, they could be buried pretty deep, and you need to make sure that the network is actually able to reach those devices to carry the data back. It's also really important that these networks, the kind of telecommunications protocols, don't demand a lot of energy consumption on the part of that smart meter, that IoT device, that data logger. You know, we're talking, again, hundreds of thousands of devices that are often battery powered. And so these things need to last a couple of years, or the business case totally falls apart. If you've got your staff running around replacing your batteries every couple months, then it just doesn't make sense to put this stuff out there to begin with, right? So that's kind of one key area, one key application that is pretty common in the industry. But if you look at something like a SCADA system or telemetry system, the needs are a little bit different, right? In that case, you're talking potentially more mission critical assets, more mission critical processes, whether that be, to your point, Reese, you know, pump stations or lift stations, storage tanks, treatment facilities. And so there is a greater need for more immediate data, more real-time data, and you need to be able to send communication back and forth. It's not just getting that data from the assets. You also need to send commands back to say, you know, let's turn this pump on, let's close this valve, to have that kind of bi-directional communication, which is a very different type of a profile, type of a kind of set of requirements than we're talking about with the smart meter. Finally, you could also look at utility workers themselves. As utility staff are increasingly equipped with smartphones or with tablets, you know, kind of replacing paper with these smart mobile devices, they need access to them as they're going about their jobs throughout the field. And you've also got vehicles that, you know, constantly in motion. People are hopefully not while they're driving, but their co-pilot is there looking at the work order management system on a tablet as they're driving out to the next site. They kind of need to have pretty steady access as they're in motion, and they need to have higher bandwidth because they're actually looking at their GIS application. They're looking at their work order management system from anywhere in that service area. And again, so a very different set of needs, different set of requirements for that type of application. And I think what's been really interesting in this research is looking at different types of communications networks, different types of telecommunications protocols, and trying to understand which ones are kind of better suited for different types of applications. And I think Nina has been doing a really good job of digging into that. So I'll let her take over and kind of explain some of those differences.
Thanks, Eric. So one thing we're seeing is that once a utility knows what they want to monitor and where, they're also carrying the responsibility to find the right network protocol. So broadly speaking, it comes down to licensed and unlicensed spectrums. Within licensed spectrums, we see LTE-M, NB-IoT, and the standard cellular network. And then for unlicensed, the ones we frequently come across are LoRa and Sigfox. And what Eric is saying about differentiating between critical real-time need and routine monitoring is exactly what helps the utility decide whether to go with, for example, LTE-M instead of LoRa. And in these decisions, we have to decide between factors like power consumption, data bandwidth, underground penetration, security, range, and of course, what's on everyone's mind when getting started with the project is cost.
Yeah, so I think you've said it, right? I mean, cost plays a role in all of these decisions, right? Depending on which protocol, if I use that word correctly, which you choose. So when that's being said, and can I step back for 2 seconds? So Eric, what, you know, as I said, one of these days, my sweet mother is going to listen to the Future of Water, and she's not going to know what a SCADA system is or what it's for. Can we just define what that is, just for in layman's terms, what the SCADA system does?
Yeah, of course. So a SCADA system is essentially the operating system for a treatment plant, or they can be used also to connect to storage tanks, to pump stations, to lift stations. But it's not a particularly new technology. It's a couple decades old, but it is basically the operating system for the treatment facility. And so typically there's, you know, the hardware component, you've got controllers that are taking data on tank levels, for example, and sending that back to the software component of it, the human machine interface, where the treatment operator is actually sitting there looking at what's happening. They're kind of getting all of these readings and they say, okay, well, maybe the water level is getting a little low. Let's turn a pump on. And they're able to transmit that command back through to the pump to kind of make sure that the system is functioning as it should be. There's also kind of alerts that are built in. So if your pump level starts to get too low, the operator will get some sort of alert to say, hey, you know, this is past a threshold that you set. You need to take some action here. And so it's really just kind of a basic digital system for enabling treatment plant operators to just watch what's happening out there on their network and within their treatment facilities and tweak things, adjust things as needed to keep the trains running on time.
That's super helpful. And I think perfectly well said, because my sweet mother wouldn't listen to me. She'll listen to you. But all right, so let's sort of keep going. Nina, we've looked at a bunch of different telecom firms, not just in the US. We've looked globally, whether it be Europe, Australia, Canada, .. More broadly speaking, how do they differ in their approaches to the water market specifically?
Right. Well, there's really three things that we see that differentiate the telecoms and their approaches. So the first group are the telecoms with the roles that we as customers or general people in the public are familiar with. So they're more focused on providing connectivity. And if they're involved in a water project, they're less likely to be front-facing and more partnership-driven. So they may, be less publicly open about their water projects, which is why we're not hearing about it more. Or two, they may stick within their role as connectivity providers, which means to sell, for example, their SIM card to Badger to use with their water meters. And to use an example here, you've got Cisco and T-Mobile. So on top of their IoT platform, Cisco also provides gateways and router hardware. But they generally rely on project partnerships when they work in the water sector. And then there's T-Mobile, which is a pretty traditional cell carrier, and we've all heard of T-Mobile. What we hear is that they want to move into water-related IoT projects, but they aren't as explicit in showing this motivation. And then we move on to the second group, which are telecoms that have a role in water projects through providing a device ecosystem. So some examples are Australian telecoms, Thingstra and NNN Co. So Thingstra provides end-to-end IoT solutions using Sigfox and the 3G, 4G network, meaning that all devices in their ecosystem are suitable for their network. And then there's NNN Co., on the other hand, which is pretty similar, but they work specifically with the LoRa network, and they certify products that enter their device ecosystem, so they're standardized with their IoT data platform. But one thing to note is that these device ecosystems include water solutions. So overall, they're more broadly IoT connections that may also cover things like asset tracking, cold chain monitoring, et cetera, that aren't necessarily for the water sector. And then the final group, which are telecoms that may have a public focus on utilities or the water industry, or they're more heavily involved in carrying out the water IoT project. And the top two companies I've mentioned is Motorola, for one. They have an industrial IoT solution for water and wastewater utilities, and they monitor temperature, water quality, water level, et cetera. And then this data is then shared securely in a network, and the operators use them to optimize pipes, fix problems like pipe bursts and sewer overflows. And then the second one is Telstra. And although it's not that explicit, they've partnered with water OEM Movis and Captis
to provide water sensors. So through this partnership, which we can see on their website, everything is packaged under Telstra as an end-to-end solution.
All right, so three groups, basically the ones that are just sort of there doing things. Then you said those, the second group providing device ecosystem. And they're, in a way, would you call them middlemen, if I can say that, middle people? I don't know where we are in the world, but is that right in saying that, like sort of play in between?
I would say so. It is like a transition from one group to the third group.
Okay. And then lastly, like you said, there are those that are like, have demonstrated a water wastewater focus. Okay. No, that's super helpful and interesting. It'll be interesting to see how that evolves. Well, Eric, within this landscape, where do the existing digital water vendors fit?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big part of why we're looking at this, or what we're really trying to understand is, you know, you've got these different types of firms. They're obviously, you know, in many cases, they're well-established, they're household names, they're, you know, very well capitalized. So what does that mean for the kind of incumbent digital water companies that we're used to dealing with? And I think the impact kind of varies, but the significance varies by company, right? So if you're talking about smaller digital water startups, these firms could actually provide really strong partnership opportunities. I think, you know, to Nina's point about the device ecosystems, if you're a small provider of, you know, a water IoT device, and you can kind of get into that ecosystem or that certification program with a major global or at least regional telecom player, you're opening new doors to new markets, new customers that maybe you wouldn't be able to tap yourself. You know, you're kind of just, you're in there, you're in their network. If they're dealing with a utility, you'll be on a list of recommended devices, and you could get some business that way. But as Nina mentioned, on the flip side, you know, a few of these telecoms firms are actually starting to be a little bit more competitive in that space. So Telstra is maybe coming to market with some water IoT devices that are competing with you more directly, and that can be a threat because, again, they are much larger. They're much better capitalized. There's also, I think, a really interesting subcurrent within all of this is the smart metering firms, right? Because there are actually a number of pretty well-established smart metering players in the US and also globally that have kind of their own proprietary network infrastructure, their own AMI networks, whether it be Sensis with FlexNet, Itron has OpenWay Riva, you know, Aclara has their own kind of network offering as well. And so they've kind of already been competing with telecoms players, right? They're already coming to utilities and saying, you know, you should buy our meters, but you also should buy our network, our proprietary network. You know, you shouldn't go buy a Badger meter and hook it up to, you know, the AT&T network or the T-Mobile, you know, cellular network. So there's already that competitive dynamic there. But I think as we're seeing these telecoms players just taking more active strategic roles, they may potentially ratchet up the pressure that they're putting on players like Sensis or Itron or Aclara. But I think more broadly, and I think the trend that's really interesting here is, you know, just generally digital water incumbents, this kind of gets back to that device ecosystem concept, as digital water incumbents are kind of seeing that these, again, pretty large, pretty well-established, pretty well-capitalized telecoms firms are kind of trying to muscle their way into the conversation and the relationships that water tech providers already have. You know, they're taking on, Reese, to your point, more of kind of a middleman or even a gatekeeper role where, you know, they're the ones who are actually going out to utilities to say, okay, you're looking for digital water, you're looking for water IoT, you want leak detection or water quality monitoring, partner with us, we'll provide you all of the connectivity that you need, we'll provide you a list of pre-certified vendors that you can choose from. If maybe one device isn't working for you, or somebody else comes to market with a better device, you can switch them out, put in a new product. You don't need to have these long-term contracts with digital water vendors. Just make sure that you have the contract with us as kind of that telecom provider. And so they're really kind of stepping in and taking that gatekeeper position. But on the other hand, you have water tech providers kind of trying to do the same thing, right? As we talk a lot about, you know, innovative business models and the data as a service or the hardware as a service type of a model, where the Xylems of the world or the Muellers of the world or the Aquifys of the world are trying to come in, kind of do a similar type of thing, right? You partner with them, they provide you all of the hardware, all of the software, all the connectivity. You don't even know whose network you're using. And it doesn't matter that, you know, the client is only dealing with that water technology provider. So they're both kind of, you know, both types of firms in different ways are trying to really make themselves front and center and own that relationship with the client. And I think it's kind of creating these really interesting competitive dynamics where they have to work together, they're partners in a lot of ways, but they're also increasingly kind of coming into competition or maybe bidding on the same projects directly.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So, I mean, at a high level, you could say, all right, we've got telecommunications firms, they understand data communications, information sharing. That's their business. They do it. I think, seemingly well. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have the water players who really understand the water. They understand the assets, how it works, and basically what the utility needs are. So I guess the question is, to what extent are they really competing? And, you know, do the telecoms players wake up every morning and say, oh my God, you know, Census or, you know, Badger Meter, they're keeping us up at night. I'm not so sure of that. It probably goes the other way. It's sort of like Northern California, Southern California. I don't think Southern California really cares about Northern California, but I can tell you that people in Northern California, yeah, they're Southern California really gets under their skin. It's like Yankees, Red Sox, same thing. Yankees don't care. Red Sox do. But I do think there is this convergence, right? I mean, that's one of the reasons we started looking at it, was to understand that landscape and where is the rub, if at all, right? Because things do change, and we've seen it happen in the power sector. Renewables was nascent at one time. Now it's the fastest growing, solar and wind are fastest growing energy or power solutions out there. Now the fossil fuel guys, or even the energy companies, you know, the oil and gas super majors, are interested in renewables now, because that's an opportunity. You know, once things reach a certain scale, the conversation becomes more real. I think it seems like we're still at the early stages, but ultimately looking forward, hence the future of water, that's sort of seems to be where we might be going. So let me ask you this, rather than talking to myself, and that is, do telecom shareholders really care about water?
Yeah, it's a super interesting question. It's something that actually came up quite a bit in the kind of the conversations that we were having. You know, I think if you think about it, right, many of the major global telecom firms out there in the world, and whether it be in North America, in Europe, in Australia, they're publicly traded, right? So they do have to answer to analysts, to shareholders, to investors for some of these strategic decisions that they're making. You know, whether it be water specifically, probably not, but you know, smart cities or IoT, the further that they push into these areas that are potentially further from their core business, the more that they have to answer to shareholders, right? And so what we found was that especially in the US, cell carriers kind of tend to live or die on the basis of their quarterly activation metrics, you know, that some of those numbers that Nina shared earlier about the postpaid, you know, net additions or activations to their networks. And so a lot of the firms that we spoke with in the US actually expressed frustration that, you know, that activation metric is really the only thing that Wall Street cares about. Even though the market's reaching saturation, there just aren't that many more activations out there that they're competing for. They're kind of just picking customers off one another by offering new deals or offering new promotions. And so there's just not a lot of new business in this market. That's one of the big issues, I think, that we're trying to highlight in this research. So, you know, to the extent that, you know, AT&T or T-Mobile or not Sprint, but Verizon, to the extent that they've gotten involved in digital water and IoT, they haven't really pushed as hard as their peers in places like Canada or the UK or Australia. In some cases, they've even backtracked. I mean, we heard, you know, IoT or AT&T in particular had kind of an IoT division that they had created and then basically disbanded that because it just wasn't that much of a strategic priority. It wasn't their focus. And I think especially now that we're seeing more big cell carriers in the US, but also globally, you know, really distracted with the rollout of consumer 5G networks. That's kind of the new potential cash cow. It's the new opportunity that everybody's after. And they're investing a lot in kind of establishing these 5G networks and these 5G capabilities. It's almost kind of opening the door for some of the smaller players, the LPWAN pure plays. And when I say LPWAN, I'm talking about, you know, LoRa or Sigfox, for example, these kind of smaller dedicated providers that are offering these alternative IoT based networks to stake more of a claim to kind of that IoT and that smart cities market as the larger cell carriers are kind of looking elsewhere, looking at 5G, looking at consumer activity.
Yeah, because I think that's really what I was getting at about, like, do they care? Do they not? Who's really competing? Like you said, if they're not in the US at this point, things are changing, though. There's more and more data out there, which leads to another question I have, and maybe throwing you guys a curveball, and that is the role of big tech, of the Amazons and the Googles of the world. They're not really in this analysis that you're talking about in any great detail, but they're looming out there, it seems, for a number of different reasons. One, they sure do put a lot of data onto these networks. That's one point. So they're involved, but also they have a lot of devices out there. And we've seen, I'd say there's signals that we're receiving. I don't know, do either of you have any thoughts on what the potential role of big tech could be going forward?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's something we'll look into in this research as well. I mean, there is there's a couple of different dynamics there. I mean, you know, I think obviously, as you said, big tech companies are major consumers of telecommunications infrastructure, right? You know, all of their customers need to be able to push significant amount of data, whether they're streaming, you know, YouTube videos or watching, you know, Amazon Prime Video or just looking at their social media feeds on Facebook. Like they're all, there's a ton of bandwidth that they're using that the you know, network infrastructure providers are providing. And there actually has been kind of a push lately in different parts of the world. I think particularly in the US, we just saw just the other day that there's kind of a push for big tech companies to actually have to help fund some of the network infrastructure rollout, and you know, particularly in rural areas that are underserved. So that'll be really interesting to see if that discussion goes anywhere. I think it's kind of nascent in the US. I think there have been similar discussions in other parts of the world as well. So that's one dynamic of it. I mean, the other dynamic, I think, Reese, to your point, is there is potential, as much as, you know, I think as Nina pointed out earlier, there is a huge kind of barrier to entry in the telecommunications space. But if anybody can get involved, it's the big tech companies, right? You know, if anybody's better capitalized than telecommunications firms, it's big tech firms. And so you see, for example, I think Amazon is doing some really interesting things with Sidewalk, right? They're basically planning to take all of the Alexa devices that are out there in people's homes and the, you know, the Ring doorbells that are out there in people's homes, kind of turn them into a big network, essentially, where you could potentially run a, you know, a smart metering network or something along those lines, basically just bouncing data, small packets of data off people's Alexas, just jumping from house to house until it gets back to the base station. So they have the potential and kind of the infrastructure in place to actually establish, and they're planning to, you know, Amazon at least is actually planning to kind of establish its own competing telecommunications network that could serve IoT and smart cities and even water applications.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. And we've seen Google, you know, they've launched broadband networks in cities, trialing it, piloting it, however you want to put it, to see how that goes. So they've got the devices out there. In their case, they've got the Google Homes and the Nest thermostats, the Nest smoke detectors. And then, you know, I don't know, Apple is probably in the same space in a lot of ways. I don't know if they would follow suit, but nonetheless, it's really interesting. That's definitely a potential disruption going forward, and they're already there. And like you said, Amazon also has other water initiatives in play, right? Whether they're working with Innovyze, specifically they got their, is it the Monitron device using artificial intelligence for better, more real-time asset management for utilities or system operators? Yeah, it can go a lot of different ways, but that is definitely one that could potentially happen. So maybe ultimately all of our MGM movies soon to be owned by James Bond. I think that's who, where you find James Bond. That'll be passed from Ring doorbell to Ring doorbell. I don't have one, so maybe I'll be out of luck and be the only person at the theater. All right, well, guys, this is awesome. I think when we got into this, it was an endeavor to figure out, okay, you know, globally speaking, how do the telecom strategies differ in water? And it is varied, like you, I think, Eric, you pointed out, geographically. The U.S. telecoms may be laggards relative to like the Bell and the Rogers in Canada versus in the U.K. or Telstra in Australia. And I know, sounds like, Nina, you're working on, you know, company profiles. So the report, it'll have, you know, 20, 30, 40 pages of analysis and then a bunch of profiles about how all of these players stack up. So this will be interesting. I'm really excited about it. So with that, Nina, once you're all said and done with this wrestling this bear to the ground, what else is on your research calendar?
Well, as we wrap up on telecoms, we'll also be shortly releasing our quarterly report with our updated Data Navigator visualization tool. And we recently did a deep dive into the connectivity landscape, so now we want to better understand who these hardware players are. So that's next on my plate, to forecast and build a competitive analysis for the water IoT market.
Nice. Well, I know that even the quarterly, I don't even think clients realize how much work actually goes into those quarterlies. And then we have a quarterly discussion about all the data that we have to collect for it. Well, guys, thanks for spending some time with me. Eric, I know you're trying to buy a house. It's hot in Florida, but it sounds like you're looking elsewhere. And Nita, you're maybe back to your nomadic ways soon enough. So thanks again for stepping up. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure all the listeners out there appreciate it. So thanks again, and take care, be well, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks a lot, Reese.
Thank you.
All right, so before we sign off, please subscribe and give The Future of Water a review. You can do that on Apple Podcasts. Can't do it on Spotify, but you can always subscribe on Spotify. So do it. Do it for me. Second, send us a note, waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com, with any topic ideas you would like us to discuss. We're doing this for you, the one and only. And lastly, just tell a friend about it. Word of mouth is the best way we can spread the word. So hopefully some of your friends and family members would like to hear more about the future of water. All right. This podcast, These Water Industry Insights, have been brought to you by Bluefield Research. To learn more about us, visit us at bluefieldresearch.com. Take care.